And that's what companies say. They forget that they have everything a startup would kill for. They have the assets. They have the brand. They have the supply chain. They have the sales force. They have everything they need, except they can't get out of their own way. So the way to not be disrupted is to look at the world like a startup does and say, I'm going to take those risks.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Terry Jones is a highly sought-after international speaker and recognized global authority in the future of business, disruptive leadership, and digital transformation. He's the author of critically acclaimed books, On Innovation, Turning on Innovation in Your Culture, Team, and Disruption Off, The Technological Disruption Coming for Your Company and What to Do About It. Welcome, Terry.
Hey, it's great to be here, Bob. Great to see you again.
Terry, I'm humbled to have you on the podcast, and I try not to overdo my introductions, but I want to share with our audience how curiosity has served you well. I first met you 30 years ago when you were at American Airlines. You had a $30 million budget to keep the largest computer system in the world at that time running. We're talking about Sabre, which automated 40 airlines and 40,000 travel agents. How did a history major working as a receptionist in a travel agency end up disrupting travel distribution twice as the founder of Travelocity and the co-founding chairman of Kayak? Tell us your abbreviated story, if you would, Terry.
When I got out of college, I was sure I was going to Vietnam. My draft number was 2, but I was rejected because I had a bad back. And I hadn't planned anything, and my college roommate, Dad, was a pilot for TWA, and he said, I'm going to get my PhD, but I want to use up my free pass before I do that, so I'm going around the world. So 3 of us went around the world for a year, and I came back and decided I like this travel thing. Went to school at night to study to be a travel agent. My dad, who'd paid for a college education, was not thrilled. But I went to work in a travel agent. 6 months in, my manager said, let's go do a startup. And that was my first of 5. We started a travel agency focused on Russia and Eastern Europe. And that was very successful. We became the 50th largest travel agency in 5 years in the U.S. And I got interested in computing. We were just starting to computerize then. Sabre and other systems were going into travel agencies. And I jumped to a mini computer company that sold systems, that wrote tickets, did invoices, and did accounting. And I stayed there for, I guess it was only 6 months, and we sold that company to American Airlines.
Wow.
We were in Tampa, Florida, and Bob Crandall came down and said, the best thing I can do is leave you here and not let anybody from American come and screw you up. So he did that for 2 years, and then they said, okay, you know how to budget. You understand big companies. You have to wear suits, and we're going to move you to Dallas. So then I started a 20-year career at American, first in running that division called ADS. Later, I ran product management, product design for Sabre, so designing all the products at one of the travel agencies. Then one day, Max Hopper, who we were talking about off camera here, said, I want you to go run 500 developers, programmers. And I said, I don't know anything about that. He said, oh, you'll do fine. So I went over and did that for 2 years, and that was very exciting. We not only did American, we did a system for the French Railroad. So I had 200 guys in France. We wrote the software for the high-speed trains. We wrote software for Russia. We a lot of outsourced stuff. And then after a couple of years, he said, no, I want you to go run computer operations. And I said, I don't know anything about that. He said, you'll do fine. That's when I lost my hair running one of the largest computer systems on earth. We outsourced 40 airlines and 40,000 travel agencies. And then I became CIO when we spun Sabre off and took it public. And while I was CIO, they gave me this little division, a little department, really, 10 people that had an online product called Easy Sabre. And it had been around for a while. I'd worked on it previously. And in those days, you could make a reservation, but you couldn't get a ticket. You had to get the ticket from a travel agent. So it was a referral system supporting the channel. And first thing I got when I took it over again was, why aren't we on the internet? It was 1996. And they were just working on that. We put it on the internet and we called it Travelocity. And it took off like a weed in the spring. It just grew like crazy. And pretty soon I went to my boss and said, who was the CEO, and said, look, I want to go do that. And everybody said, well, you're nuts. There's only 12 people and you're CIO of this big company. I said, no, I think that'd be more fun. So I did that. And I was, for 6 years, I was CEO of Travelocity. After a couple of years, we took it public. It was public for, I think, 4 years. And then Sabre bought it back because they wanted to control it rather than the public market. And I decided to leave at that time because I thought they would screw it up, which they did. They took a $1.2 billion company and later sold it for about $280 million.
Wow. So
they bled off a lot of value because they took it apart and there was nobody in charge of it. And then, so that got me through Travelocity. Then I became a public speaker. My brother's one. He got me into that business. I started speaking on innovation, digital disruption, started joining boards. I've now served 20 public and private boards. And then I was working at a VC firm looking at travel, and we got this idea for kayak.com, which was vertical search and travel. And I served there as chairman for 8 years or 7 years until we sold it to booking.com for $2 billion. So that was a great exit. And since then, well, we'll probably talk later, I did an AI company. I'm now chairman of an AI travel company in Canada, consulting with a bunch and still speaking and still on boards and writing and having fun.
I tell you, Terry, that's just an incredible story. And it's not uncommon to people who have been successful like you've described. And you've spent the last decade here working in AI. You've been teaching entrepreneurs and industry leaders. You're trying to teach them how to turn innovation on and disruption off. And I want to discuss two of your books today. I want to get into some of the details of each one of them. And ultimately, I want to show how they're so relevant in today's disruptive AI. So let's start with On Innovation. This was published back in 2012. And to me, it was so easy to read. It featured 72 good ideas. So you don't have to start at the beginning of that book and read it to the back. You can flip through it and look at different things. And each of those really has some great questions to ponder afterwards. So these ideas were formulated, then you can think about them a little bit. And I've seen a lot of good ideas blocked and trapped in culture. Why do good ideas get blocked? What happens? Why does that happen?
I think what happens is that we get risk drummed out of us, particularly as corporations get larger. Every corporation was started by a risk taker. Edison, Henry Ford, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, you name it. They took risks. But when corporations grow, they tend to stop taking risks. Maybe not Apple and Musk's companies as much, but larger ones do because I've got to deliver the corner. And our operations muscle gets really strong and our innovation muscle kind of withers because we don't want failure. And if you want to move ahead, if you look at a laboratory, experimentation includes failure. And so corporations have to be willing to fail. I was lucky enough to work for Max Hopper and Bob Crandall, and they understood that. And well, I lost a lot of money in failed experiments, but they're okay with that. If you learn from it and move forward, if you make the same mistake over and over again, then they're going to put you on the bus. But there's a lot to be learned from failure. And I think that's why good ideas many times get buried.
I've heard you refer to this as the bozone layer.
Yes.
Explain what that means. I think I've encountered that myself.
The ozone layer. It's the impenetrable layer of middle management that stops good ideas from moving upward. Because they don't want to stick their head up. And if the thing fails, then their career is off track. So my mantra is to kill projects, not people. It's probably the project that failed, not the person. And obviously, if the person fails again and again, they're not the right person to be doing innovation. But usually, it was a bad idea, or the market didn't like it, or some part of the team didn't execute, or whatever. And so what you have to do is say, look, this is Bob's project. It went great. This is Barbara's project. It failed. We're promoting her. I spent $1 million putting DVDs in stores with videos on them because you couldn't send video over the internet back then. And I lost $1 million. Did it with IBM, total failure. Nobody liked it. And I went to my boss, Mike Durham, who was the president and had been the CFO at American, a really tough guy. And I figured I was getting fired. And he said, what did you learn? And that really helped change the culture because people heard that I didn't get fired. No, I knew I couldn't lose $1 million again. But
right. I'm one up on that.
It happens in big companies that you make a bet that doesn't play out.
Yeah.
And so I think the other thing is you have to circulate ideas of why. At American, we had an idea program for a while that required you could submit an idea and it went to your manager, but it went to two other managers of different departments. Because your own manager, that might be an idea that goes against the idea that got her job, or she just doesn't think it's a good idea. So the more people who see it, the more people who get around the idea and say, wait a minute, I think that's pretty good. Shell has an internal Kickstarter. So if your idea doesn't work in your department, you can go to the Kickstarter department and get it funded. Pretty good idea.
I ran into the boson layer. I was doing a startup within a large corporation, and I had a great idea. I'd only been there about a year, and I went in and presented it to my leadership. I thought I was going to get fired. They said, there's no way in the world we would ever do that. Why are you even thinking that way? And that's when I learned about the boson layer. Actually, I experienced that, then I read about it in your book.
Yeah, we got a name for it.
It was pretty
that
real.
Was a lot. And yeah. And I met a guy from a big oil company. I actually ran into his wife. I was speaking at the board, and I said, what's your husband doing? He said, he's in charge of biofuel. And I said, how'd that work for him? She said, everybody hates him. His oil doesn't come out of the ground. And it's weird. 6 years in, it's the most profitable division of the company.
Yeah.
But he had to fight for it for a very long time.
Terry, you hold several patents. These are protected ideas. What's the difference between an idea and an innovation?
And actually, those patents are ideas. They look good. I can see them on my wall over here. But none of them were turned into products. Sabre didn't buy into them. Some of them were from my failed AI startup. Innovation, you've got to bring it to market. It's about shipping. It's about taking that idea and turning it into a product, which may mean twisting it, bending it, changing it, getting people excited about it, funding it. A lot. You've done a startup, all the things that it takes to go from idea to innovation. But it really is about shipping it, you know, getting people to purchase it, getting them to buy into it. Otherwise, it's just a great idea. When I was a kid, we started throwing the top of a potato chip can. Chips used to come in cans. And we started throwing them on the beach, and we saw it could fly. And I said to my dad, we should make a toy like this. And he said, I'm in the advertising business. I don't do that stuff. And 4 years later, Whammo came out with a Frisbee and made millions and millions of dollars. So we had a good idea, but it wasn't an innovation.
I'm glad that Jay's potato chips never happened into a Frisbee for you, because if it did, it would have changed your life entirely.
I'd been an entrepreneur at eight or whatever.
Oh, that's so funny. That is a great story, though. I like hearing things like that because there's always those regrets. And I can't tell you how many times I know people that have thought up something and they go, someone's already made it. They've already made it. That kind of happens concurrently.
Well, a big article today, I think it was the New York Times and the Washington Post, about Shark Tank. And one of the big products they turned was Ring, which later sold for $1 billion.
Yeah.
Not everybody can pick a winner all the time.
So, Terry, I've heard you mention before that thinking up new things and innovation is about new things, okay, creating. And you say that innovation rests on two pillars. And those two pillars are culture and team. So how does culture and team work together? How does that turn these ideas into action?
In a culture, we've talked about some of the attributes of culture, like celebrating failure and being open to new ideas and being open to change, celebrating change. But you've got to have a team that's a glass half full team, not a glass half empty team. So there are only certain people who really enjoy innovation because it's risky. There's no path to follow. You don't know where it's going to go. I mean, the 10 people at Travelocity in the beginning were all like that. When we had 3,000 people, many of those 10 people left. They didn't want to be in a big operational company. You know, Jay Walker, the guy who started Priceline, had an incubator for a while. Mm-hmm. And he had starters, growers, and runners. So he'd say, Terry, go start this company. And once it got to a certain size, he said, come back and do another one. I'm going to give it to a grower. They're different kinds of people. So you have to have a team, I hope, of A players, because they produce a lot more than B players. And that's critical in a small team. At Kayak, we went public with 200 people. And you have to really search for people who want to innovate, who like change.
So, Terry, you've been taking risk. You told us your story here. And throughout that abbreviated story, you've been taking risk your entire life. And it's pretty obvious the rewards have been pretty substantial. But this risk, it involves experimentation and failure. And you've been a huge risk taker. What do you do? What do you advise people to do when you're faced with risk?
I think people will take a risk. Look, in the circus, they shoot people out of a cannon, but there's a net, right? So you try to obviate the risk so that you don't fail totally. And the great thing about today and starting companies today is we used to say it was two guys and a dog. Now it's two guys and an AI. And you don't have to take huge risks. You can experiment with 3D printed prototypes. You can experiment with AI testing online. You don't have to raise the kind of capital you used to have to raise to figure out if the idea is any good. My son, for example, started a gaming company. He left Electronic Arts, the top company, and four guys spent 2 years building an amazing game. And they outsourced everything they didn't know how to do. It was a risk for him, but he was young. And the game was a fair success, but they didn't create a company. But you know what? He got so many job offers after that because people said, how'd you do that with four people? Come work at our studio. Now he's got 350 people and a $200 million budget building a game for Microsoft. I think you can reduce the risk today. Obviously, it was a big risk for me when I left the CIO job to go run Travelocity. I had a family, a mortgage, a big salary. But I thought, you know, I can land on my feet. I can get another job, but this looks like a lot of fun. And I'm motivated to doing things I like. In college, I got A's and F's because if I didn't like it, I didn't do it. And finally, as a senior, I could get all A's because I was majoring on what I wanted. But I kind of gravitate to what I like.
I tell you, you make reference to a two pizza size innovation team. If you have more people than it takes to feed two pizzas, you need to scale it back a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, that's an Amazon idea that I credit in the book, but it's a great idea because big teams, they spend too much time communicating with each other. It's like at Sabre, we had four of the biggest IBM mainframes and we needed more capacity. So we bought a fifth. They said, your capacity will only go up by 25%. I said, it's going to spend 75% of its time talking to the other four. And that's like innovation. We really worked hard at Kayak to keep our team small and we were successful, but we also worked hard to have super A players.
So we've been talking about innovation, your first book. Let's move on to the second book, appropriately named Disruption Off, as opposed to Innovation On. And it was published in 2019. That was 7 years after the first book. And you refer to innovation and disruption as two sides of the same coin. Go deep on that. How's that related, two sides?
I'd say disruption and innovation are two sides of the same coin. It's only disruption because you didn't do it. If you did it, it would be an innovation. But so many companies look and say, how did they do that? I have a clip from the movie Butch Cassidy in my speech where Robert Redford is saying, I couldn't do that. Could you do that? How can they do that? Who are those guys? And rather than you coming into the board meeting and they say, you're an idiot, we would never do that. That's how you avoid being disrupted because you have all that talent. Now, sometimes you can buy it. I was with a big insurance company recently and they bought an insurance startup that was kicking their butt, but they didn't integrate it. They just left it like it was and used it as a lab. Other times you can integrate it. Or you can sponsor it yourself. But it's darn hard. One of the reasons I think I get hired as a speaker that Travelocity started as intrapreneurship and then went public. And a lot of companies want to know the lessons for that. And there are four primary lessons in the book that talk about why it succeeded. And Expedia was the same thing. It spun out of Microsoft. A lot of people don't know that. Priceline was a regular startup.
So, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, Expedia started. In fact, Bill Gates came down and talked to Bob Crandall, our CEO, and I was there, and he wanted to partner with us. And he said, we'll do the front end because we know PCs, mainframes, you do the back end. But negotiating that, we could never, it was porcupines making love. We couldn't get it done. We're two big companies that wanted to both drive the bus. So they did it themselves.
So Terry, looking at the timeline of disruption, and you've seen it all, you've seen the evolution of technology moving to the internet and then mobile and now AI. You saw what happened in right sizing from the mainframes down to the networks, those different disruptive players in the mobile technology, Apple, Nokia, Microsoft, Google, all those transitions, those evolutions, they took time. But how much faster, in your opinion, is disruption with AI?
AI has taken a long time. There have been a lot of AI winners. I started an AI company 10 years ago, and the tech worked. It was limited, but it absolutely did what we said it would do. But corporations were not ready to adopt. We couldn't get hotels to change their websites. We couldn't get convention bureaus to adopt. We got some. We had more pilots than American Airlines, but we never got people to pass. And eventually we changed and moved our AI product into marketing, because marketing people will buy anything, right? They always want to try something new. So I think AI now will accelerate disruption for sure, because it is learning so fast. And that's what people forget. These are learning systems. If your competitor has a learning system and you don't, how are you going to catch them? Tesla has billions of miles of driving knowledge. John Deere has AIs that have memorized tens of thousands of farms. And they know exactly where to apply the fertilizer, where to get more water, what the weather pattern is. Are you going to go get a Massey Ferguson that doesn't know your farm? No, you're not, because they own that brain. So I think that's why things will move fast. But I think it's incumbent upon corporations to go beyond, yes, I'm using ChatGPT in marketing, really to think about, how do I deploy in my products to make substantial impact? And some are, and many are not yet.
So recently, I listened to a book by Mustafa Suleiman. He's the CEO of Microsoft's AI. The Coming Wave is the name of his book. And he just talks about the exponential growth, how fast things are growing. And we think linearly. We don't stop and think how fast things are going. But he makes a good point of that in the book. He talks about NVIDIA and the technology development. They have a processor now that does 12 teraflops. A flop is a floating point operation per second. But a teraflop, basically, that's a trillion floating point operations per second. That's 1,000 billion.
And the billions of transistors that are in your phone.
Yeah.
Remember my transistor radio, I think it had 4.
Yes. And he talks about how powerful these computers are and how much they can drive AI and do superhuman things. And he said, if you think about what a teraflop is, if you had 1 billion people and each of those 1 billion people had 1 million calculators in their hands, and they all had the same math calculation, a multiplication, they all hit enter at the same time, 1 billion people with 1 million calculators each hit enter, that's a teraflop. That's just incredible, the technology that we're sitting upon right now.
No, quantum will take it even farther.
I know. And you're talking about that in the future too. So I just think there's some pretty powerful things. I'd like to learn more about your introduction to AI. You got a call from the CEO of IBM, Jenny Rometty, and she asked you to help teach IBM Watson about travel. Is that where it started with you? Where did it go from there?
It is. And I had gotten to know Ginny because I'd done a bunch of speaking for IBM. And she said they were looking for applications. And she remembered me. So she called up and said, would you come to Armonk? And I said, yeah, will you give me a ticket? And she said, no. I said, all right, there's got to be money in there somewhere. So I went and I did a bunch of evangelism for them. And I got to know the general manager of IBM Watson, a guy named Manoj Saxena, a wonderful entrepreneur. And he eventually left IBM and wanted to start several AI companies, one in travel. So we partnered together on that one. And at the time, he wanted to do a consumer company. And I said, we can't. And he said, why? I said, because the models can't be big enough in those days. We can't. If somebody says, what's the best Singapore sling to drink in Singapore? Where can I get that? We can't answer that. We'll get trashed on social media. So we decided to make it smaller and to concentrate on hotels and convention bureaus. And our idea was to use natural language search instead of the interface I designed in 1996, which is still on every travel site. Where are you going? When are you going? What do you want to do? So instead, we want to let people say, I want to go to the Caribbean in January in a super deluxe hotel that has spa and golf. And we find it for them. In addition to doing that, we analyzed millions of images so that we could show the right image at the right moment. And we read millions of reviews. So what would happen is if you said that, I want a great hotel in Singapore on the hill with a pool, what you'd see then the next page was the hotel and the picture of the pool and a review of the pool. Today, that would take you 25 minutes. You'd have to go click the filters and all that stuff. So it worked great. And we learned a lot about it. We used Watson for a while. We found that Watson had a lot of limitations for a reseller. It was good in some of the hospital environments when you were surrounded by lots of IBM guys. So we wrote a lot of our own code. And it was just very difficult to get people to accept, even though we had empirical results that showed higher conversion rates. So we were too early. I've been too early several times in my career.
Sure.
It's unfortunate, and travel is just now dipping their toe into it. And of course, the models are much larger now. But also you have people realizing a lesson that I learned from someone at IBM. That I think the most impactful AI products are like a layer cake. And they'll take public data, like OpenAI, industry data, like the International Air Transport Association, or all the flight data, and then private data. And it's the private data that's most interesting. So take TripAdvisor. They have 1 billion reviews. What a great database to use to help people plan travel. Nobody else has that. John Deere has the tractor data. Tesla has the car data. That's the data, but you need to combine it with others. So I'm chairman of a travel company now that wrote their own NLP 8 years ago, but last year we threw it out and said, let's just use GPT. We've built all the other hard parts of this. NLP is now a commodity. Let's buy it, rent it to do the language translation from natural text to verbs. We don't need to do that ourselves. We're going to do the other part.
So was your AI startup Wayblazer, was it disrupted?
What was it disrupted?
Yes.
No, it wasn't disrupted. It just was too early.
Just so too early.
We couldn't get adoption. It worked, but large corporations, B2B sales in large corporations, and I'm doing that again now, is to be way harder than consumer. It's getting people to adopt. You have to find the right person in the company who's willing to take risk and who wants to hang their head on innovation and move up the ladder. And most people are too conservative for that. And we made a mistake. We were selling to IT, and IT has a list of things to do a mile long, and they didn't want another one. We should have been selling to the CFO, saying, look how much money we can make. So we didn't have the right salespeople. We made that mistake. And we made some other mistakes. Actually, my book would have told us not to make, but we were partners and we both had an experience. We thought we knew the right thing to do. We didn't always agree. So stuff happened. And the good part is that when it failed, we had trained AI engineers and they all got jobs in a day in Texas. So they went out. They're doing well. And I learned a lot about AI, which I can now teach people to help them make new mistakes. The ones I made.
That's part of the experiment, right? Is to try, fail, improve, see what works, what doesn't work, and keep moving forward with that. Jenny Rometty, she made a statement once. I want you to try to interpret this for our audience. Don't ever protect your past. Yeah. Don't ever protect your past. What's meant by that?
That's a great quote, is that what worked then isn't what will work now. You and I both saw Lou Gerstner come into IBM Here's a guy coming from a cigarette company, and he turned that business upside down. And he didn't change the tech so much as he changed the culture. He changed the leadership. He put rocket fuel in there. It was amazing to watch. And then Ginny came along, and she was an insider, so she didn't change it as much, but she was certainly willing to let go of things that weren't doing it anymore. I mean, you think they started as a calculator company and, you know, now look at the current CEO. I mean, they bought Red Hat. They've gone to open source. They flipped again. That's how you're a 100-year-old company, is that you don't have to protect the past. You look at how Bob Crandall changed the airline business and was totally willing to let go of old things and understand how much, for example, automation, Sabre was worth more than the airline for a while. He was very flexible about it. You look at Scott Kirby at United, and he's taken some big risks and pulled it off while others like American are struggling. So I think you can't sit on your laurels. Look at the risk. Big article today in Fortune about Mary Barra. Betting her company EVs. When she took over the company, it was in the tank, and now it's doing very well. And the EVs haven't come as fast, but she says disruption and transformation takes a long time. And there are a lot of bumps along the way and no road signs. So you have to be willing to take the heat. And a lot of companies are just managed for today and next quarter, and I want to do a big stock buyback and get rich, rather I'm going to invest in my product. I'm not a fan of stock buybacks. I have objected to them on boards and been chastised. But if you can't invest in your own company, come on, invest in your product, invest in your future. Don't just do this crazy mouth calculation. Stock buybacks used to be illegal.
So disrupt them off. You talk about that, and I want to wrap the book here up. AI is so disruptive. What makes AI so disruptive, in your opinion? You mentioned some areas that make it pretty disruptive. What is that?
I think it's, first of all, it's disrupted because of the computing power that can be put against large problems. You're in healthcare. Think of the problems. I know my partner Manoj talked about it. The most rewarding job he had in AI at Watson was helping drug discovery reduce discovery time, because you can make so many experiments in parallel and simulate so many things so quickly. Secondly, it learns. And corporations don't learn as well as they ought to. If corporations were run like baseball teams, where they measure every single at bat, it would be different, but we lose that corporate knowledge. So I think it can take all these data that we have, that we've collected in these giant data swamps, and really create new products of them very quickly. Is it going to replace some people? Yes, but it's going to, if it's like every other technology, it's going to create more jobs as well, which it's already doing. So I find it fascinating how quickly it's making change. And I urge companies to adopt it in more than marketing and try to understand how they can use their data and their products to create something that's quite advanced in healthcare.
I look at a summary of the book, Disruption Off. It forces me to review technologies. And you make a metaphor there. It's like having a reviewing the technologies. And it's a kind of a strategic retreat with the book. That's what you do as a company. As a company, we would pull off and say, what do we need to do? Let's look at our strategy here. And you talk about three things. You mentioned it earlier. Ready, set, and go. That's the strategy. Ready, set, and go. Explain what those mean.
I think you have to create a culture that's ready for change.
Okay.
It starts at the top. It starts at the top because you want people to understand they can take risks and you kill projects and not people, and that you're listening to what's happening below. And then you really need to listen to what's coming up. But then, as you said, you have to review your capabilities, your technologies. You have to review what the customer is asking you for, and you have to ask IT to say what technologies might solve those, but also what technologies haven't we thought of that could change our world? Bring us the microwave oven. Bring us something we haven't thought of marketing at all. And then it's go in the execution, and that's where so many of these projects fail. Because either they lack sponsorship or they don't hold on long enough, or they don't fund it enough, or they're not willing to have some losses in them and understand there's some failures. I think particularly today, as we look at how technology is combined, as you said, and as this Microsoft fellow said in his book, that's the exponential change. And we have to understand how that combination of technologies can either power us forward or put us out of business.
Terry, we've talked a lot about the book. There's way too many topics that we can cover. You go into AR, VR, blockchain, robotics, data science. There's just so much in there. And so we'll leave that for the readers to follow up on. I'd like to close by talking a little bit about your corporate engagements. What motivated you to go down that path? You keynote and talk to most of the large Fortune 100 type companies. How'd that get started?
My brother is a National Geographic photographer, and he's been a lecturer for many years on creativity, using his images. And when I was at Travelocity, I did a lot of speaking at American Airlines, and I got pretty good at it. And he said, you might be able to do this for a living. And so I thought, okay. And I met, there was a lot of demand for the story of Travelocity because it was entrepreneurship. And then I took that and said, I got to make that broader. So I started thinking, do I have a set of lessons here about innovation? I've done four startups by that point. And then I changed into disruption, and I currently speak. I have a speech called AI is the New UI and another speech on AI. And I get great satisfaction out of doing that. And it's large corporations, usually trade associations. And it's fascinating. I did three dairy speeches this year. I did one for the American Dairy Association that spun into more. I didn't know a lot about dairy. They're amazingly advanced. Many of them are using AI. I went into a dairy barn with no people in it. Just the cows come in and they walk into a milking station and knows what to feed Bossy and knows how to milk her. And she walks out and no people. And I asked the guy there, I said, how's it going? And he said, not very well. That's one of the guys. I said, why? Is it AI? He said, no, it's my brother. I said, what's wrong with your brother? He said, he doesn't trust the AI. He changes, he tinkers with it all the time and gives the cows different food. He said, Bossy's telling me what she wants to eat. You got to listen to the data. I might take that and take that to another industry that I'm speaking to the next week. And I just spoke to Chrysler and Jaguar. How can they think about those things? So speaking to all these different industries and being different boards, I'm on the board of two cybersecurity companies, chairman of this AI company. It just brings lessons that you can teach when you're out speaking. And I find that very rewarding, and hopefully the audiences do too. So I enjoy it. And I do speak to healthcare audiences as well. I've enjoyed that. Lots to learn there. And lots of application for these new technologies in healthcare.
We need a lot of help in the healthcare space. It's such a fragmented, and we still use fax machines, okay?
I know, because they're quote secure. I just went, Peter Diamantis and Tony Robbins started a healthcare company called Fountain Life, and they have a facility in Dallas, which I went to, and they do a half-day complete diagnostic. It's like the physicals I had 30 years ago when I was at American, but so much more advanced. The most advanced MRI, the most advanced CT. I was tested for 40 cancers. Yeah, and people say, why do you want to do that? You're older. Right. I said, because they can fix a lot of this stuff.
That's right.
Diagnosis. That's the level of technology that hopefully the cost will come down and the AI will improve and will spread it around the world.
Terry, we have a lot to learn about innovation and disruption. Thank you for being our guide. This has been very helpful. I tell you what, I'll remember this. Disruption is here, waiting to be leveraged.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.